From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I confess to a decided dearth of roses here in my northern garden, with only a few species types in residence. But today's guest is positively surrounded by roses daily. Adam Gloss, a graduate of the prestigious Longwood Gardens Professional Gardener Training Program, joined the Scott Arboretum staff at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania in 2012. He's responsible for the Dean Bond Rose Garden there, which was first designed in 1956, then recently renovated to be more sustainable. So yes, listeners, we're finally going to get tips for organic rose care today, both cultural techniques and advice on selecting more resistant varieties. Now, if you're near Swarthmore, PA on May 25th and June 1st this year, treat yourself to a rose garden tour, or just listen along as we get a virtual visit with a resident expert. So welcome, Adam. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Okay. I bet you're working hard. It's that time of year, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, boy. I thought we should get just a little brief background. First, maybe about you. Did you know you'd become a rosarian? You studied horticulture and so forth. Was that a direction that you were headed in, or did that just kind of happen?
Yeah, it just kind of happened. Having the rose garden here at the Scott Arboretum, it was just sort of a natural progression into roses. Not necessarily something I looked forward to taking on initially, but happy that I have now.
Okay, so you've kind of warmed up to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then a little bit about the garden. So I mentioned in the introduction, it was first designed in the 1950s. So sort of paint a picture of it for us. Is it a traditional-looking rose garden?
Yeah, initially when it was designed in the 50s, like you said, it was a traditional rose garden. The original garden was laid out in five beds. There was a bed designated to species roses, another two beds for climbers and shrub roses, and then two more beds that were just grandifloras, hybrid teas, and floribundas. There weren't any other types of plants in there, just roses, so a very traditional rose garden.
And is it I feel like the pictures I've seen, is it sort of surrounded by, the more traditional, also the sort of posts and swag, the chain sort of swag? Is there like a border around it? Do you know what I mean? Is it sort of enclosed?
Yeah, the one, what actually kind of sits right in the middle of campus, right in the heart of campus, and it basically sits in the middle of a big lawn. So it does feel a little bit exposed when you're in there, but there is that post and chain structure that sort of creates a little bit of a sense of enclosure when you're in there.
And so you said that originally, anyway, there were these five beds, and they were divided by sort of class of roses or whatever, and it was all roses. Do I take it to mean there's no underplanting, just mulch or something, or are there herbaceous things underneath the roses today?
Correct. Originally, it was just roses and mulch, basically, but now we've transitioned to a much more dynamic planting scheme. Roses typically bloom heavily in late May, early June here in the Delaware Valley region, and then they take a break, and then, they'll flower again late August and into September. So for many reasons, we wanted to create a little bit more of a dynamic space. We've added shrubs and perennials, a few annuals as well, about 120 different varieties of clematis as well.
Oh, my goodness. Did you say 120?
Yeah, give or take. That's not an exact number, but there's a lot. There's a lot.
Wow. So, how many kinds of roses are there?
There's about 165 different varieties of roses in there.
Okay.
So we've got species roses, shrub roses, hybrid teas, grandifloras, floribundas, climbers, you name it, we have it.
And are there multiples of each one? Or?
Yeah, typically there are. As we've moved into sort of a more sustainable approach with the garden, we're trying new roses, new genetics and new breeding in roses for roses that are supposed to be disease resistant and, very adaptable for this region. So a lot of times we'll try one to see how it does, and then we may get a few more in if it does well.
I see. So with that in mind, then, you mentioned sustainable, and so how, when did this sort of, I don't know whether there's a renovation or what you called it, but when did this happen, and how long in the making, and how long since, and so forth? A little bit of the sort of history of that, because I know you're involved with various sustainability projects that pertain to roses as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So they've been trying to sort of renovate and rethink the rose garden for about 10 years now. And when I started here at the Arboretum about 5 years ago, I was approached with the concept of renovating the rose garden. And, you know, I was excited about, for the opportunity, but also along with that, the college really has a very strong role in sustainability.
Right.
So we wanted to do it in a more sustainable way. So it's maintained organically now. You know, we used to go in there every 10 days and do a different cocktails of fungicides to control disease, but now it's completely organic. So we've gotten away from what you would consider a traditional rose care.
So that must have been a pretty massive shift. I mean, here you have this, you're describing it as like sort of in the middle of campus, in the middle of a lawn. Like it's seen by a lot of people all the time, and you can't mm-hmm. have it all like defoliating and looking horrendous. It's got, right? I mean, this is
right,
conspicuous.
Right.
This is not hidden in somewhere in the back corner.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
So to accomplish that, were there changes to the soil? I mean, what happened? Did you dig out plants? I mean, what all happened? Or was it just a change in the cultural practices?
Yeah, sort of all of the above. And so a lot of the roses, they were, you know, way too close together. They had, you know, overgrown a bit. So the first year in the transition, I literally just spent the entire first year pruning, you know, removing suckers and spacing roses out. Along with that, we did change the bed configurations a little bit, you know, expanded some of the beds, moved some of the beds a little bit, but the footprint basically remained the same. In terms of the soil in there is beautiful. You know, since the garden was planted in the 50s, we add about 3 or 4 inches of leaf compost, wood chip mulch mix yearly. So the soil structure is wonderful and lovely.
Okay.
So that's a huge advantage, you know, going into this type of system is to have a good soil base to work off of.
So before we go to the next step, you said first year, you know, you spent pruning and spacing. And so for people who don't know, a lot of rose, quote, problems, you know, come from fungal things. And so air circulation, getting plenty of light and air is like a great antidote to that. Is that sort of basic idea of what you mean by saying you spent this time pruning and spacing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, light and air infiltration is critical in terms of, you know, a lot of the fungal pathogens that roses can get, especially black spot. Black mm-hmm. spot is the biggest issue in our region with the roses, keeping them healthy and happy.
Right.
That also allowed us room to incorporate other plant material as well. I said, we incorporated clematis, but we've also incorporated perennials and some other shrubs as well.
Oh.
And initially, the entire plant list, you know, for perennials and shrubs that we introduced, all of them had traits that were, you know, attractive to beneficial insects and pollinators as well.
Oh, interesting.
To kind of try and create a more healthy ecosystem in there.
So you were sort of diversifying this, like, community, this little habitat of this rose garden. You were sort of diversifying it, huh? Wow.
Exactly.
So now, give us some examples of perennials and shrubs that went in there that did this beneficial attracting kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of the shrubs that we chose were shrubs that bloom, you know, off-season from the roses. So viburnums that are blooming very early to draw some early pollinators in there,
right,
as well as some spireas and, you know, some lilacs as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've incorporated a few Ito hybrid peonies in there that bloom early as well, but then also, you know, salvias and achillea and geraniums, perennial types that, you know, extend the intra-season as well as attract pollinators also.
Okay, so you're having not just these two big moments of bloom and then sort of not much going on, but you're having a much more sustained floral display on all the levels from much earlier to the very end of the season, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. I like to think it's a much more interesting, dynamic garden,
right.
As opposed to sort of a static rose garden.
Right. I sort of derailed you, interrupted you. You know, first year you did this pruning and spacing, and you said the soil is really good because the protocol, even when you were still doing the chemical cocktails to counteract some of the diseases and so forth, or you weren't personally, but the previous protocol was to do that, was that they were also doing a good thing, which is adding these multiple inches of organic mulch that was sort of, you know, breaking down, and the soil is fabulous. So what happened next then after the sort of pruning and spacing and the diversifying? What other elements were there to the sustainability project?
Then sort of came in the sort of baseline that we established here as to what was acceptable and what wasn't in terms of disease.
Right.
Like I said earlier, especially in terms of black spot. So when you're maintaining a rose garden, specifically in an organic matter, you sort of have to develop a threshold of what's acceptable and what isn't.
Right.
In terms of your aesthetics. The next few years was basically just kind of evaluating the roses and seeing how they were responding to the new system and whether or not they were a good fit for this program.
Okay.
If they looked good, great. If not,
did they feel the pressure?
The oh yeah, absolutely.
I think they knew what you were doing looking at them sideways. All right. So you knew that once you established this sort of new regimen, that you then had to be kind of cutthroat about who worked and didn't work in this new protocol, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
Exactly.
So you did a couple of years of that, and even though that some had been pruned and spaced better and given these companion plants and so forth, some still didn't cut it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, roses, like I said, are so regionally adaptable. Something that's bred in California or, you know, the South, where, you know, it's hot and dry.
Right.
They're definitely not conducive to growing well in this humid, you know, sort of moist summers that we have here.
Right. And that's important for people who are listening in other areas of the country. You know, you're kind of mid-Atlantic, I guess, When figuring this out, this part of the adventure that you're talking about now, one has to really do research and not buy 20 of some new thing and plant it, but like you say, test them out, try something, see how it does for you in your environment, inquire at botanical gardens in your area to see if they have a good rose garden, you know, what insights can they give you, things like that, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
you got to look
mm-hmm.
for clues.
Yeah, and as we were going through this transition, we worked closely with New York Botanic Garden because they have a lovely rose garden there that's also maintained, you know, in a more sustainable manner.
Yes.
But even just, you know, the difference of, you know, 90 to 100 miles between New York and here,
yeah.
We would try roses here that were doing really well up there, and they just did not perform for us in the
yes.
you know, region, just that short distance away.
Did you note that, you know, some classes, I guess I keep using the word classes, I'm not sure exactly if that's precise, but some types of roses are less disease resistant or more so? Like, are there some, you know, you had talked about how there's species roses and climbers and shrubs and grandifloras and hybrid teas and floribundas. Are there some groups within those that are like, ugh, these are the ones that are the weakest generally? Or it was all over the map who was good and bad?
Yeah, it's a little bit all over the map.
Okay.
I tend to see the ones that haven't had a lot of breeding and genetics, you know, in their background tend to do a little bit better. So, you know, more of your species roses or something that has a little bit more of a pure line of genetics
right.
have a tendency to be a little bit more disease resistant.
Right.
You know, that just has to do with, you know, sort of breeding for specific traits, you know, most of our roses are bred for the cut floral industry. You know, they're not necessarily bred for the garden.
Yes.
And, you know, breeders and hybridizers of roses are getting away from that, and they're now really focusing on, producing sustainable roses that do grow well in the garden.
Do you want to tell us some that you adopted or or cast out? Maybe, I don't know if you want to, winners and losers. Were there any that, you know, that you found were, you know, have really done well for you or?
Yeah, there's, I certainly have my favorites for many reasons, but, Summer Sun, has done really, really well for us. It's a Floribunda type rose. I planted it, 2 years ago, and it's just done really, really well. It's, you know, a lovely orange of orange sort of mixed yellow rose that's just really performed well for us. Home Run is sort of the base. It's a series. There's a Home Run series of roses, and Home Run is sort of the base of that series. That one's done really, really well. It's a shrub rose. You know, flowers for a really, really long period of time. It's a nice kind of single red rose, and just very, very disease resistant, very sturdy in the landscape.
Who's the Home Run series? Where does the Home Run series come from? Is it a well-known breeder or whatever? Or is it,
I'm not sure who hybridized it, but they are starting to develop new genetics in that series.
I'll
We just got sent a few to try.
Oh, good. Oh, interesting.
That haven't been introduced yet, so hopefully they'll do well and they can introduce them onto the market.
Okay, so those two are a couple winners.
Yeah, a climber that's done really well for us, Cloud 10. It's a white.
Cloud 10. I was going to say it must be white.
It is. It's definitely white. But, you know, with a lot of these roses that they're breeding for sustainability and disease resistance, the fragrance tends to be the first trait that gets lost. But this is one that actually has a really, really nice fragrance. It's a pure white flower. It's heavily double, and it's a pretty good climber. Has done really, really well for us. And actually, the hybridizer that developed Knockout Rose has developed this rose.
Okay. So those are some of your treasured favorites at the moment. So you just mentioned a climber, and I guess those pillars or the swags that we talked about sort of at the perimeter or whatever of the garden, is that what they're trained, some of these climbers are trained on?
All of our climbers are on that post and chain system.
Okay.
We do have a couple of other trellises within the garden that we're starting to train some roses on, but they're mostly designated for clematis at this time.
Okay. And so, I mean, that must, so you must have a fairly substantial collection of climbers if because there are all those posts and chain sort of things, yeah? So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's about 20 climbers in the rose garden right now.
I saw on the list there's a nice little brochure about the garden, and I saw the name of a rose that, of course, I had it a million years ago, and it's long gone. I don't know how to pronounce it, but Veilchenblau or whatever, Veilchenblau, sort of a bluish lavendery colored. I guess it's a climber, yeah? Is it a rambler or a climber?
It's a rambling rose.
Yeah, a rambler. Do you still have it?
Yeah, we do have it, and it's lovely. I would say the nicest trait about that one is it's nearly thornless. So if you know, you're scared away from roses because of thorns, that's one you might try.
I've seen it trained up almost like onto a pillar, you know, made this more vertical thing, and then I've also seen it sort of almost like a big octopus, you know, like big open.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a beautiful color, though, that sort of lavendery blue color.
Another
that I love is because it gives more than just the flowers, is the blue-leafed rose. I don't know whether it's called rubrifolia or glauca anymore. Do you grow that as well?
Yeah, we have several of those, and I agree. It's one of my favorites as well. You know, roses typically tend to be a one-season sort of plant, but that's a four-season rose. You know, you've got really lovely blue-gray foliage, you know, nice flowers. You know, it's a single flower, only flowers once, but a lovely pink flower. And then, you know, in the fall, you get hips as well.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, we have maybe like 4 minutes left tonight. I want to ask you quickly about fertilizing. You don't do nuclear holocausty stuff anymore. But
right.
are you feeding like organic rose foods to these plants?
Yeah, we actually use fish hydrolysate. That's our you know, disease control as well as our nutrient.
Fish what?
Hydrolysate.
Hydrolysate. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's basically fish oil.
Okay.
And through the growing season, we spray that on about every 10 days.
Okay.
It definitely stinks when it's wet, but as soon as it's dry, you don't notice it.
Okay. Huh. Interesting. Fish hydrolysate, and that's a food as well as a preventive.
Right. It's basically fish oil. So
okay.
It kind of creates a little bit of a surface on the leaf, so fungal spores and pathogens don't really have a chance to sort of land and
love
and
it. Never heard about that. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And I don't suppose any conversation about roses in this time in history can happen without asking you rosette disease.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Big plague in the industry right now.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there's not really a whole lot that you can do about it. Once the rose has it, our recommendation is to remove the rose and destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
But providing proper cultural care as well as, pruning properly and, good spacing of the plants and good healthy plants is kind of the only thing that you can do for it. It's caused by a little mite that travels by the wind. So
it's a mite.
Aerophyte mite. So it's pretty random, if you get it, but unfortunately it's pretty devastating and there's no real control once you have the disease.
And when you say destroy, you don't mean put it in your compost heap. You really mean destroy. You mean get it out of there. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And,
I've heard of people burning it or, doubling it up in a bag and sending it off to the landfill, that kind of thing.
Right. And it shows itself as like this sort of disfigurement, does it?
The growth that happens, it's very contorted growth.
Yes.
The inner nodes are really short, and it typically is kind of gnarly looking and red. The foliage is, definitely different in terms of color from normal foliage of the rose.
I thankfully haven't seen it. But I know that it is something that my readers and listeners ask about a lot, and many have mm-hmm. suffered through its showing up in their gardens. So, tricky stuff, tricky stuff. Are you going to be giving some of the tours in May and June? Do you do any?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yep.
Okay.
I will be giving the tour in June.
Mm-hmm.
And if I happen to be in the Rose Garden and visitors stop by, I'm happy to chat with anybody who's visiting the garden.
Absolutely. Well, what I'll do is I'll give contact information, obviously, and links to more information about both the Scott Arboretum at Swarthmore and the Dean Bond Rose Garden. Adam Glass, I'm so glad to speak to you finally. Nice to get to know you a little bit. And thank you for this info on sustainable care of roses. Much appreciated.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Nice to speak to all of you again as well. And I hope you'll tune in next week. Don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.